Interesting. All right. Good evening or good afternoon, everybody. This is Danny Sheridan. I'm this first new battalion chief, and I'm going to put my speakers in. Sorry about that. Should have been more prepared. Put my headphones in. I should have been a little bit more prepared here. So, actually, today is my birthday, so I'm recording this a little early. I should be going live tonight at, I guess, normal time, 7:30. So, 59 years old today, and the world, I cannot believe how much has changed just since the last time I did this show, which was probably about 6 weeks ago. The whole world is upside down right now, and we got a call here. So how do we do this now? Hello? We got a caller? Unknown? Oh, Chris? Chris, you there? Okay. So anyway, so the world has changed this last 6 weeks. The COVID-19, I was working for a while with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, and we were in charge of helping them round up and collect all the casualties from the COVID-19, bringing them over to the morgue. And, it's been interesting. My guys were getting hit pretty hard, with the responses, the medical calls. Some of the engines were out all night doing this stuff. And anyway. Hey, Chris, you there?
I'm here, Danny. Can you hear me?
Oh, now
I can. Hold on.
Yeah, I didn't know where you were.
Okay, there you go.
I lost you for a few seconds. So I'm just trying to just get an intro going here. How much the world has changed in the last 6 weeks since I last did my show with the COVID-19, and now we're in like this new territory now. Things that haven't been seen in the Bronx since the 70s. You know, the civil unrest.
Goes without saying when you take a look at it nationally. You know, you talk about the Bronx, you talk about New York City. As early as this morning, just taking a look at social media across the country, everybody's seeing the results of obviously both the protesting and the rioting that's occurring, and more notably is the severity of the fires that are occurring in the urbanized areas and even the suburban areas. But urban fire conditions, commercials, and many of the other retail buildings that are going up are certainly challenging all of the operating companies out there.
Yeah. I think I saw the New York City FireWire, and as of last night, I only know of one commercial building they had on Jerome Avenue last night. But I'm afraid that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that things are going to start happening, because it's happened in the past, and if you don't remember history, you're probably doomed to repeat it. So here we are, right? What's interesting is that with the way things have been happening in the last 2 months, one of my officers mentioned, he says he thinks that we might start seeing an uptick in commercial building fires, and that's actually going to be our topic today. And it's kind of subtle, but at first we had I wasn't working for the first two. There was a good fire in a it's all in this one boulevard in the Bronx. It was a storage warehouse, like one of those used store places. And that was the first one. And then there was another one where they took a dumpster and lit it up inside a building. And then the day I was working, it's funny. It appeared to me as just being like a rubbish fire, for the first 10 minutes, my mind is thinking that it's a rubbish fire underneath this loading dock in this kind of yard where they park trucks. And they were doing some kind of wholesaling out of the place with dairy, like milk and eggs and stuff like that. And I thought it was very innocuous. I thought it was just a simple mishap. Maybe someone threw a cigarette under the loading dock. and I treated. And then I was getting reports that there was smoke inside the building. So I told the deputy, I said, you know what, I'm going to just take a look inside, you know. I went into the building, and it was charged. I mean, it was like a huge like kind of warehouse-type place, and it was pretty charged up pretty good, you know. And I'm assuming that it's smoke coming from the rubbish fire through this exhaust fan thing. And we called for some fans, and we were able to get some fans set up, and, you know, we got it cleared out pretty good. I took up. I left the other chief there because it was really his fire. I came in as, like, the all-hands chief. It actually was my box, but we were on something else, and then I got there as the all-hands chief. And I didn't have a really great feeling when I left. I was like, you know, there's too much smoke here for this to be a, you know, residual. So, but I didn't think much more of it. About an hour later, the same box came in, same building, but on the other side. And, again, I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be just a residual smoke because it was a big building. Maybe it was, they're having trouble clearing it, you know. And I got a report from the first new truck officer. He's like, hey, you know, ladder one to command. He says, you know, we got some charring up here in the beams up in the ceiling. And I was like, whoa, hold on, you know, so. You know,
it changes the game plan. I mean, with that building intel and, you know, additional information is coming from the companies and so forth, you've got to be very fluid in terms of what your assumptions are and what the actuality of the incident is, especially in the commercials. I mean, we're talking about large footprints, large or small. Again, we can have a small commercial that has a relatively small footprint, but all of them have some degree of volume in terms of the size of those structures, which is the biggest game changers when we talk about moving from something that's a little bit more compartmentized than any one of our other types of occupancies all the way up to the big box type settings where you have tens of thousands of square feet.
Yeah. So this would have been, this was been a disaster because there was a paint shop. It was a woodworking place. It was tons of combustibles inside. So I went through the motions now as if we had like a working fire. You know, we stretched a line. I had trucks doing searches. I put the whole thing into operation. And I met the fire marshal outside, and I thought it was kind of unusual, but I guess because it was a commercial building, the fire marshal was going to show up. He says, hey, chief, you know, this was electrical. He said the fan, the exhaust fan, which I thought was just a port for the smoke to get into the building, had been actually the cause of the fire. He said that it was, it was overheated because it kept trying to turn on and turn on and turn on. And which is kind of funny because at some point I actually thought about using that fan to clear out the smoke in the building. But I said, I better not touch this thing, you know. And, I thought about it and – you know, given these trying economic times, right, we make assumptions. And, you know, arsonists or owners, you know, if they're in dire straits and they get desperate, you know, sometimes they make choices that probably aren't the best, you know. And, you know, who's to say that owner didn't leave that fan on and stuck a chalk in there and purposely did something like that? You don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we have to really keep our eyes open now in this in these times because I think if this continues the way it's going, we may see this uptick again in some. And now you lump on this antisocial behavior coupled with the economy, we're back to the 70s. You know, I mean, it's just like
you've got to, you know. Due diligence. Don't make the assumption that it's just going to be a normal job. You have to have a heightened sense of concern relative to the risk in terms of what could it not be in terms of the normal day-to-day types of fires that one would get. So if it's anything but that, especially if it's something that's intentional, or again, you talk about going back to the 70s and early 80s, again, any of the other booby traps and other types of owner-inflicted hazards that could be present in the structures that, again, it's a game changer in terms of how we're going to be operating and the level of caution that one has to put in place.
Right. Well, you just hit the nail on the head. So that's what I was leading up to. So here's what I'm concerned about. You couple the economy with the angst and people trying to hurt first responders. I've seen it firsthand. I remember, you know, the vacant buildings, you know, when I was, a new guy. And we were told to watch out, you know, for lots of things, you know, booby trap holes. I used to find holes in floors, stairs were missing. We'd pull into the block, and they would be launching cinder blocks off the roof. I mean, it's just this is where we're at. We seems like we are again, you know, and it's unnerving. I thought that would never happen again, you know, and here we are. It's 2020, and seems like it's happening all over again, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, in a blink of an eye, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, so getting into commercial buildings, right? So, you know, where I work, I'm in Hunts Point. We have a lot of factories. But, you know, a lot of the commercial buildings in New York City, speaking for New York, are what's called taxpayers, right? So a taxpayer, basically, just the name alone, it really kind of describes what it is. It was built... There was really three categories in New York, right? There was one category that was between like 1900 into the 20s. Then there was that period from the 20s up into maybe the 60s, and then the 60s on forward, you know. And they're not built, you know, they're not like built like a castle, you know. They're not built, you know, they're sturdy. They're flimsy, you know, not lots of fire protection, lots of voids, and, you know, something that we have to consider, you know, like when we're responding, like, you know, I have to tell you my own personal view at this point now with some of these taxpayers is that I think we need to sometimes even treat them like a vacant building. And it's funny with some of the stuff that's written about, like, say, bowstring trusses, how we're supposed to operate is very similar to how we're supposed to operate in a vacant building. So, this is something that I think firefighters have to keep in mind is that these buildings are not, you know, they're not built. They're not the strongest buildings, you know. So,
well, if they lack, you know, they typically don't have the level of integrity or resistance that one would find in a better built or a more code compliant type structure. So at the time of construction, they met the minimum code requirements, and maybe even at best they may have had some less than quality or desirable conditions, but they're not going to withstand the assault and the impact by even small size fires, you know, whether we talk about the voids or the exposure to the construction and the materials depending upon when they were built. So if we know up front and have a level of appreciation both from command and an operational company level that, hey, the building's integrity is already questioned as it exists, then you throw heat and fire into it, and that may further exasperate it and cause it to have premature conditions. And that's you have to be aware of and develop those street smarts in terms of time and operations.
Right, exactly. So this is what I'm – you know, I know that, you know, guys, they love to be aggressive, and, you know, they all want to be inside, you know. But I think there's certain things that we have to look at before we make that decision, you know. And I don't know too much about what happened in L.A. I have a cursory knowledge of they had a fire, and I think it was some kind of they had some kind of oils or some kind of flammables being stored inside, you know. And, you know, I think one of the things that we have to think about when we're responding to commercial buildings is, when we do our size up, you know, the occupancy, but what does that denote? Like what's inside, you know, like what are they storing? You know, like we had that fire, Father's Day fire in 2001, where a good friend of mine, Brian Fahey, was killed, John Downing and Harry Ford. And, you know, they were storing chemicals in the basement, you know, and you have to expect the unexpected in commercial buildings, because, you know, you never know what's inside. And, you know, you don't know how long the fire's been burning. These are things that's part of the size up is, you know, what's the occupancy, You know, what are they selling? You know?
Well, Danny, you know, you talk about occupancy types. There's also, and again, you talk about the Father's Day fire. There's also the occupancy risk. So depending upon what the occupancy usage is, coupled with what is being stored in other elements, that also creates an occupancy risk. So, again, based upon the size, the construction, roof systems, the building material, the era and vintage in which it was built, coupled with that occupancy commodities, creates sometimes a higher level of risk that has to be managed, again, from command and the tactical level at the company. So if you're going into, let's say, whether it be a hardware store, that naturally is going to have a much higher level of risk regarding combustibles and flammables and other products that are going to be in there that are going to create much more intensive and labor-intensive fires. Or you go into a small footprint commercial building that many of our listeners have, a small standalone, more modern type constructed building that's either concrete masonry units or maybe prefab construction concrete panels with a common steel beam and bar joist assembly. Again, you have a different level of risk regarding how that building is going to perform within a time span. One may have a much lesser degree of time to operate and get under control before bad things end up happening. And the other may have even a shorter duration of time, which now may influence your tactics. You may go to a different level of tactical approach and maybe has a fixed system in it. I mean, there's a lot of variables in there, but that's, I think, the most important part of it is you've got to understand that building when you show up, especially if we're talking about the commercials. You know, what is its usage? What's the occupancy? What's that sign saying? What are you dealing with at that particular time? Is it during the daytime, weekend, nighttime? Are there other factors, as you started talking about, that might influence and direct your operations command-wise relative to civil unrest, or is the area experiencing some downturns because of the economy? So here we are coming slowly out of the COVID pandemic. Businesses have been closed for numbers of months. Now we have two factors. We have economic distress, similar to what you had back in the 70s with arson for profit and so forth. Now we have the same thing occurring. You know, is there something that was accidental or was it intentional? What's that occupancy risk? Do I have enough personnel even on scene to initiate an aggressive interior attack? I mean, you know, not everyone is built the same regarding our companies and the profiles and even the efficiency of response. Are they heading out the door and getting in there in that 4 to 6 minute duration, or do some of our departments out there, you know, taking them in a considerable length of time to arrive, and how much fire do I have? Because all of those things play out significantly in regards to the safety of the companies to be able to engage and work either within or around the building. So, you know, some of our structures, as you talked about, the taxpayers, there's some rules of engagement that are pretty straightforward that we learn through street level smarts. But there's also that unique new building. And again, it may look like it's got a Q deck, a metal deck, and a steel bar joist with some beams and girders in there. But it very well may be a type 5 parallel cord wood trusses. It may not even, again, lightweight engineered construction may be part of that assembly. So, you know, you've got to look at those variables, because next thing you know, you're underneath it or on top of it, and the building is not going to have that stability to allow us to do what we normally do tactically.
Yeah. So speaking of tactics, so, you know, the one thing that I would like to discuss first off is that, you know, we can't do anything. I'm an advocate of we have to locate the fire, right? But we can't make assumptions, right? I know some of the newer taxpayers don't have basements anymore. But generally, it seems like fires kind of start in the either basement or in the rear, and then they'll just travel up in the cockloft or whatever, you know. And I know just in New York, the way the roofs are pitched, it, like the high point is at the front, so the travel, if it gets into the cockloft, it's gonna travel that way. So we need to locate the fire. I remember. A fire in a commercial, I don't know, it was probably back 20, 25 years ago. And, you know, the companies went in without really thinking about what was going on, they just made an assumption that the fire was on the first floor. Heavy, heavy smoke, high heat, but no visible fire, you know. And the guys are in there, and they're opening the line, and they're not hitting anything. It's just like they're just opening on smoke, you know. And it turned out that the fire was in the basement the whole time. And it's like free burning now that whole time they're in there. So my fear is that guys don't locate the fire, and if it winds up – and this could apply to any building, even a private dwelling. Or, and the fire's in the basement, and you're above it, and you're thinking that, you know, the fire is on the first floor, and you're above it, the fire is going to continue to eat away at that at the joists, and, you know, you're going to be in danger of collapse. So I think it's imperative that the whoever it is, whatever rescue company or ladder company or however you search team, needs to locate the fire and communicate it to the engine company. The engine company, I don't care in a commercial building how much fire there is. The way we operate is that we're going to stretch it 2.5, right? There's like, we have a little, I had an acronym for when we stretch it 2.5. It was Dallas, D-A-L-U-S. You know, if it's going to be purely defensive, advanced fire, large area, uncompartmented area, or size unknown. And kind of commercial fires kind of fit the bill with that a little bit. You have to stretch 2.5. I know guys, sometimes they say, well, it's only one room. You know, it's so much easier to, we'll just do the 3/4 or the 1.5, whatever. You don't know where that's going to go, that fire. There could be fire somewhere else, and before you know it, you're in the middle of it. So it's good practice. We do this in New York City. Taxpayer fire, we stretch 2.5. Do you know differently, Chris? Is there any departments that don't have any kind of hard and fast rules to stretch 2.5?
There are many. So, yeah, when you take a look at the national perspective, it's all across the board there. There are those that advocate the 2.5s. There are many other departments that still rely on the mobility, tactical mobility of the 3/4 or even the 2-inch line. I'll bring up one important line of duty death that occurred in a small footprint commercial. So this was a strip mall type setting that occurred in Michigan. And I'm actually trying to see if I can find the report number. But this occurred in Michigan, just outside of Detroit. And this ended up leading to a single line of duty death of a young firefighter, combination department. And again, the operations all revolved around the initial fire attack line being 1.5 inches. So, and this is in 2013, Danny. So you talk about what you have available for resources and economics and money and budgets and so forth. So the guys respond out to a typical small open footprint commercial building, strip mall, direct access from the parking lot area, and they have both a restaurant and a billiard occupancy, relatively large in terms of the square footages, but again, common the type of common types of structures that we all see. So they've got fire within the structure. They're stretching in. But just as you described, the fire was actually extending rapidly up above them in the concealed ceiling, drop ceiling. You've got substantial rooftop units that are sitting on bar joists that are sitting on top of a steel I-beam. So as that fire is communicating and you're trying to suppress it, possibly with inadequate fire flow and gallon per minute. So if you talk about 1.5 hand line versus you're talking about 2.5, and here we are, you know, exemplifying an incident that was going south with 1.5 hand line. They're about 50 to 75 feet within the building. It's about 100 foot in depth. And again, when things start going south and beams start expanding due to that heat impingement, the natural sequence of conditions. Again, we have sequence of events where a beam starts moving, it's pocketed into the wall. That beam starts causing the steel bar joist to start moving. That heavy 1,000-1,500 pound rooftop units that are very common starts imposing that weight. So the weight comes down on the Q deck, starts pushing the beam. The beam's twisting. The bar joists are starting to become elastic. And what ended up having is the delta wall ends up pushing out, causing that entire roof to come down. So there's a lot of lessons that are common when we talk about understanding the roof construction, understanding roof hazards. You just talked about location, extent, and fire, and what are we actually – are we getting heat conditions? Are we actually putting water in the fire? Then you talk about gallon per minute flow rates. Then you talk about whether we even should be in the building. So, I mean, that particular event significant because, again, about 4 and 8,000 square foot footprint, typical 1960s, 70s vintage strip mall, hand line usage, and a lot of other things that came out of it. That, coupled with the other most recent commercial fire report that came out of San Antonio, and again, it goes right back to what you just talked about in terms of gallon per minute flow rates. So, again, our listeners should take a look at the San Antonio, Texas, both NIOSH and the departmental report that came out in May of 2017. And these guys are fighting a fire in a during off hours. Turns out to be an arson fire. So there's the other thing that connects here. So unbeknownst to them, it's an arson fire, which has a deep-seated fire in a gym-type setting. So the gym itself didn't have a lot of occupancy load or fire load, but because of the flammables and combustibles that were introduced because of the arson, we have a fast-spreading fire. Companies come in, again, steel bar joists, a very large square foot commercial mall with, again, common types of tenant spaces that are interconnected up at the concealed ceiling part. So you don't have fire protection between tenant spaces as you typically even may not have with your taxpayers. So, again, this is 2017. Mm. That led to a single line of duty death, but that report had a lot of good insights on training, the culture, risk, command issues, understanding the building construction, and so forth. So that's San Antonio from 2017 and the other most recently documented commercial fire that led to a single line of duty death was the 2013 in Michigan. So if our listeners want to connect some things here of recent, those are very, very good reports to gain a lot of good insights on that we're talking about here today on this episode.
Yeah, you made two good points here, and yeah, you know, I wish we were live, and I wish people could call in because I would really love for someone to contact me and tell me why they think engine to record is a good idea. Because here's the thing, since I came on a job, I've never questioned it, right? I mean, I wasn't in the engine company. I mean, I was an engine officer and as a lieutenant and a captain, but I was never in a firefighter. And I know the 2.5 is a big pain in the ass. I mean, it's a monster, and guys don't like stretching it, and I get it, but, and I get the speed and mobility of an inch and three quarter. I know there's someone on my job right now who is advocating now that we change our thinking inside commercial occupancies inside multiple dwellings. And, you know, when you talk about the open area and the large amount of combustibles, I remember one year I was in FDIC with the authors and I was talking with John Norman, and like he was adamant about 2.5 in any commercial building. And I agree with him. I'm like, yeah, you know, I can't argue. You know, you just, that's, it's one of those things that like was taught to me and I never questioned. And I don't think I need to drill into it. I mean, as an officer in an engine company, I always, I wouldn't even think about stretching an inch and three quarter in a commercial building. I mean, it's just something that wasn't done. And if you did and the chief got wind of it, I'm sure there'd be hell to pay, you know? So,
but that, you know, Danny,
I don't see the value.
But that goes back to the rigor of the job. So if the bosses and everyone involved, you know, knows what the standard is. But now take a look at that small size department, that combination or volunteer department, where there isn't that level of rigor. There may not be standard operating procedures. There may be limited experience, and these guys show up on a job in a commercial building. So they will only revert back to what they are accustomed or conditioned to deal with. So bread and butter operations, residential. They're set up for 1¾-inch operations. They may not even have hose beds that are set up for commercial fire operations. So, you know, there's that distinction that just says and screams at you, saying you've got to look at your first due, you look at your mutual aid, you look at what you're responding to. And typically these commercial buildings are low frequency, high risk. I mean, they're in most jurisdictions, right. Most response areas, there isn't that frequency. We may be seeing that uptick now, but low frequency, high risk. So now are they set up to establish, do they even have any kind of hose bundles, you know, with 2½-inch lines to be able to go deep into that footprint. So now go back to your comment about the layout and the square footages. Do you have the ability to stretch that 150, 200-foot line when you may need 300, 400, or 500 feet to get into that area or that bay within that large footprinted structure? So, you know, there's a distinction between the big box, 10, 15, 20,000 square foot, and then you talk about the smaller footprints, and then even the smaller, more conventional 5, 8, 7,000 square feet. So there's fire stream management, and I'll throw this other one in here too. There's also going to be air management. You know, we've seen time and time again some near misses where these guys have gone way too far in. I mean, they know where they're at, but now we've lost that situational awareness. We've lost control of where we're actually at, and that ties into, again, another significant line-of-duty death on our job, and that's the Southwest Supermarkets fire with Brett Tarver in Phoenix from May 14th of 2001. Again, orientation. You're working in a particular location, but you know, you've got these large floor areas, you've got aisles, you've got other commodities. It's going to mess you up in terms of knowing where you're going and trying to follow the lines. Again, when you talk about a number of other events, guys are trying to follow the lines back out. They're coiled on top of each other in compartmentized area or large square footages. Once you lose track of that line or lose continuity of where your company is, very, very likely you're going to get yourself into a jam up.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I would say, as you know, speaking now to those that are in command, like a battalion chief or I don't know, whoever establishes command in your department, you know, I'm advocating that we stretch it 2½ in a commercial, right? Like it should just be a hard and fast rule. Like this is a commercial building, I don't care how much fire there is, you're stretching 2½. But you as the incident commander should be thinking about the next step. Like, if this 2½ doesn't do the job, like, where are we going from here? Are we setting up deck guns? Are we setting up monitors? You know, we call them the Stang, Akron, New Yorkers, whatever you want to call them. That can be – the 2½s can be converted, if they had to be, into, like, a monitor. Are we making room for a towel ladder? I mean, this is – like, we have a small window in commercial buildings, I think. You know, especially at the time. If it comes in – usually they come in after midnight. They've been cooking for a while. And sometimes we even get these things in the middle of the night. You get a passerby, and they get a whiff. And then, you know, next thing we open the roll-down gates, and it's lights out, you know. That fire could have been cooking for hours, you know. And I just don't think it's prudent. I don't think it's good practice to go in there with 1¾-inch. I just think you're really rolling the dice. You know, I mean, I wouldn't do it. And I would just love to hear an argument why maybe you think you should. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at. I'd like to know what the other side of it is, because I can't see the other side. I can only see the bad side of it, where, like, this is going to go bad, and then we might be pulling guys out and setting up towel ladders and deck guns, right?
Well, again, go back to the Charleston Superstore fire, and again, the lessons and learnings. We talk about commercial building, you talk about fire loading, you talk about tactics and operations and what the outcome may come. So again, in all support, God rest the souls of our brothers that lost their lives, there's lessons out here that can reinforce what the potential outcomes may be. So again, you know, for some of our listeners, again, we talk about Charleston, that's 2007, that's you know, half a career on the job in some instances. And I'll tell you a story. We were teaching at FDIC a couple of years, quite a few years back, and a bunch of us were, there's three or four of us teaching, and doing my program up front. We're talking about construction and some tactics. We're talking about Charleston. And Chief Joe Pernesti, a good friend of fire engineering, and he's got his radio program mm-hmm. from Ohio. Joe's out in the mm-hmm. in the back of the room, and he says, hold on a second. And he comes forward because he sees a couple of guys in the middle of the audience. There's about 100 and something in the room. And he goes up to them and says, and these are a couple of young guys. So he asks them a simple question. He goes, do you have any idea what he's talking about? And the two of them said, no, sir, we don't. They had never heard of the Charleston Superstore fire, any of the events mm-hmm. that, again, define our generation of firefighting. Again, 9 line of duty deaths. So he asked them how many years they'd been on the job, and they said just a couple. They were from a small career department. But, and again, this is mm-hmm. in like 2010, about 3 or 4 years just afterwards. But nobody mm-hmm. had told them about a significant fire such as that. So, you know, the other part of this is that we're not learning the lessons. We're not reading. We're not becoming literate. We're not listening to podcasts, radio programs. We're not asking the bosses. We're illiterate in terms of fires and learnings and so forth. So, you know, it's very good that I think we revisit this at this time, as you described, because of what potentially may be coming down the road. I mean, again, this morning, Sacramento had a 5-alarm job, commercial building. Fires are extending into other occupancies. We talk about these recent line-of-duty deaths over the last number of years. They are infrequent, but very well may become a frequent occurrence. And there's a lot of lessons and learnings, just you talk about, acronyms, gallon-per-minute flow rates, having your head, you know, focused in at the company level and at the command level. So command can't make too many assumptions. The company has the mobility to really pick up on some building intel. What is normal? What may be off normal? What's your gut telling you? Are you experiencing significant heat conditions in an area that should not have them? Are you encountering some noises and conditions within that structure that, again, may be indications that, you know, something is going to start coming down on you? And again, what we don't have in commercial buildings is a lot of time to screw around. In other words, we've got to be decisive. You have to have good building intel, and you have to react accordingly. And again, we talk about roof collapses in the various bays. We may be lucky because of the way construction's set up, especially in larger footprinted areas, that we've got a little bit of ability to take the brunt of a partial collapse. But when we have catastrophic large area failures, it's not going to be a good day for anybody operating on that scene.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you know, working our way kind of up the building. So, you know, locating the fire. But one thing that that we have to be wary of is, and especially some of the older taxpayers, is these suspended ceilings. Like, it's not uncommon to have a tin ceiling and then a drop ceiling, and then maybe even, I know you're not in, by code, you're not supposed to have more than two, but, you know, sometimes code is code, right? And what people do is what people do. So what I worry about is that companies, you know, cutting the roll-down gates or making entry and going in, and, you know, and another thing that scares me in this modern, you know, firefighting age, you know, with this reliance on the thermal imaging camera. So now guys are going to go in about 10 feet, scan with the camera, and nothing's showing. They look up and nothing's showing. And yet maybe in the ceiling that is not the actual ceiling, but the next ceiling up, there's fire rolling over their heads, you know, that they don't know about. So,
well, you get that masking effect. So, yeah, the masking effect in those voids, Danny, is exactly what you're talking about. You may have that false sense of what you're reading, or what may be limiting the what the camera is reading may not be defined by what's in that space above. You know, in other words, you may have products, you may have commodities, you may have stuff hanging down from the ceiling that's masking and creating another barrier that may not give you the indication of what the temperature gradients are and what actually may be burning. So that it's just not the normal course of what you were going to find in your residential or small retail. So, you know, here's a, I'll give you a quick little insight. So just the other day, I'm at a fairly large commercial, it's actually a supermarket. So I'm in the supermarket, and suddenly as I'm waiting in line, my 6 foot differences, again, I'm starting to look at all of the clear plexiglass that have now been hung to separate, you know, us from them. And in one particular area, it's sort of a little bit of an alcove, which some sprinkler protection systems. But again, the design, when that was set up, both in terms of detection and suppression, had an open area going from that compartment into the larger, higher bay area adjacent to that. But now they put in the plexiglass, which also has a flame spread, depending upon what kind of materials they're using. But we've created these artificial separations that are suspended, that are also imposing upon weight on the ceiling up above, but they're creating different conditions. So, you know, we talk about the new norm. When you're out there either on or off duty, take a look at what's changed in terms of barriers that have been set up to create pedestrian flow paths going in and out of your businesses, because that's changed the layout. What you expect to be an open area now might have these artificially placed or temporarily placed the dividers or products or shelving, because again, the COVID issue was all about maintaining distance and so forth. And then we add the plexiglass and all of these divisional barriers. Again, it's going to create something that's off norm that now may have an isolated collapse condition. It may bring down a section of ceiling. It may limit the effectiveness of your hose line. So now you've got a fire on the other side of this plexiglass, and you can see the fire glowing and so forth. You set up your line, but you've got this plastic there that hasn't failed yet, and your hose line is bouncing off of it. So little things that are part of today's norm that are changing up the game.
Yeah. So I was working the night, and if anyone's listening, they should really Google this explosion. It was a place is called Sidetracks. I don't know what it would be on YouTube, Sidetracks or Sunnyside or Sunnyside Explosion or whatever it was. But I was working that night, and I took interest because Sidetracks was a place that I used to go to when I was younger, right, growing up in the neighborhood in Woodside in Queens. So I heard the second alarm. I immediately turned on the Queens frequency, and I started listening to what was going on. We got relocated to one of the battalions in Queens, so I was able to hear all the transmissions, you know. And if you see the video, it's like it's only by the grace of God we didn't lose 12 guys that day, because it's just like this massive explosion, right? It blew out. Someone was on the subway station up above, was taking video. And if you watch it, and if you knew what was going on, you could kind of see this almost coming, you know. And this is something that I think needs to be discussed, because, you know, roof operations in these types of building scales, it just scares the hell out of me. That's where a chief really, you know, that's when you're doing your job, man. It's these kind of jobs where, you know, guys, you have like 10 guys on the roof, you know. I actually spoke to some of the guys that were working in Rescue 4, and they said the heat was incredible inside the store. I mean, it was just like super hot, you know. And if you watch the roof ops, I'd like to know other people's opinions, but they were operating a hose line up on the roof, you know, and I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but when they opened that front door, that's when it blew. So I don't know if it was a coincidence, but I would just say as a takeaway, you know, if you feel the compulsion, you're on a roof and it's like, well, here, look, the fire's coming out the vent hole. Let's just put it out. You know, that vent hole is there for a reason, right? The vent hole is there to vent the building, to vent the, you know, to vent the store or the cockloft, right? And by putting a hose line, now, I'm not saying this is what happened in this fire. It's just I saw the line that was on the roof. I couldn't see what was going on, but it's probably just a coincidence or whatever. But I'm just saying it could be like this tendency to think like, well, here's the fire, let's just put it out. But you just got to remember what the purpose of that vent hole is, you know. I read, I happened to just this morning, I was just doing a little research on this, and I read, it popped up, I wanted to look into trusses because, you know, trusses, they come and go, right? I remember when I came on the fire department, that was the hottest topic, right? They had two of them down in the South Bronx where I worked, like in the mid-80s, right before I got on the job. And, you know, it was at the time, it was very topical, you know. And then it was a result of what had happened on August 2nd, 1978 in Brooklyn. And I read something for the first time. I was just doing a little reading on it. I wanted to actually talk about mezzanine levels in taxpayers, and I saw something about a trench cut being done on that roof, and I'm like, I never heard of like trenching. You know, it's not successful in a taxpayer. You know, it's just, I think, too much of an area, and especially I can't imagine trenching a bowstring. So I don't know, Chris, could you, I know you wrote that. I mean, could you just, you want to just kind of bring us up to speed on that?
Well, our listeners, certainly if they're not aware of it, again, on August 2nd of 1978, a fire originated in the Walbaum supermarket in Brooklyn. At the time, it was 2892 Ocean Avenue, which has now been replaced by a Staples store, but early morning fire and operations as they were. The supermarket was occupied. It was under renovation. So any of the, if you go online, we have an extensive insight on both the event in terms of some data and information, as well as a lot of photographs on the firegroundleadership.com page, on the fire engineering blog pages and such. So long story short is that deep-seated fire, it actually was in a mezzanine area in the middle to the what would be considered the delta side of the building, but toward the center, off to the delta side. Companies are operating, again, commercial building. We've got engine companies operating down below. We've got, with 2.5-inch hand lines, you've got the ladder companies opening up extensively up into the roof. Now, this particular bowstring was over, it was a heavy-duty bowstring, number one, 100-foot in span, clear span from bearing wall to bearing wall. The outside, if you take a look at the images, will show you the actual column locations and the pilasters that are there. So, again, if our listeners are not familiar with those terms, look it up. Become knowledgeable, because these are going to be key size-up issues. So the guys are trying to work. Numerous rooftop openings were initiated by the ladder companies. Second alarm was struck. And, again, this is all within this 15, 20-minute duration of time. And due to the fact that they recognized that fire was impinging upon the heavy timbered truss component near the wall area, near the parapet, while the suppression is being undertaken. So when you look at the images, you will see that there was a significant amount of deep-seated fire. Unfortunately, nobody completely recognized that, yeah, it was in the truss loft of that roof, and that roof is very similar to what they had in Hackensack. So almost 10 years to the month. So in July of 1988, Hackensack, or 10 years later, the Hackensack Ford fire occurred in 1988. That actually had a similar kind of construction where you could actually go from compartment space through the trusses into the next adjoining space. That's how tall they were. That's how wide, and they actually had storage conditions in there. So companies had numerous openings in place trying to ventilate. Bottom line is that they had multiple concealed ceilings in there, so you had fire running in these locations. They were attempting to strip cut that location in a more sizable area because, again, there was roof construction that was being done in place, and we actually have some images both prior to the collapse. And they had a lot of resources, and, again, we're talking about 1978, and unfortunately the failure occurred within that 20-minute mark, and it was catastrophic because with any type of truss system, the bowstring trusses of East Coast, and this is an important distinction, East Coast and West Coast trusses are distinctively different. So when the first bay went, that one truss came down, it brought both. So truss number five, which was the main truss that failed, two adjacent trusses because of the way the roof is constructed with the wood decking, it will normally bring down an adjacent truss. So if one truss goes, it's going to bring the truss on the other, on either other side of it down. So you end up creating a much, much larger collapse zone, which came down. We ended up having 12 firefighters that went into that fire. Six did not survive. Six were rescued by the companies that were operating. I mean, again, there's a lot of history and a lot of insights in it. Vinnie Dunn does a great job of talking about it. Brannigan talked about it. We've got our insights online. As a matter of fact, for our listeners, if you go back and do a search, so on our radio program, on the Buildings on Fire program, we did a 40th anniversary podcast on fireengineering.com, and you can go back through. So if you go back, I believe it was it was 2000. We did an encore program for 2019, August of last year, but the original episode was in August of 2018. And Chief Dunn gave some great insights. We talked about that whole operation, both from construction and tactics, for a two-hour period. So some things to tie into all of this. So, and the only other thing I'll mention, Danny, is just quickly on the tactical side, is that East Coast construction is different than West Coast. So some of our listeners are going to be very familiar with what they're doing out in California, West Coast operations, where they are, again, putting in the companies are going up and they're strip cutting and trench cutting. It's labor intensive, but again, the construction may allow you the time to initiate that action from parapet to parapet to do that, even with heavy fire involvement. But the construction, without getting into all the details, the construction is different. They are built with a different type of material. Although it's wood, it's constructed slightly differently, which gives it more integrity. Then coupled with the earthquake retrofitting, that's why the guys are operating on these types of roofs when our guys on the East Coast are screaming and yelling, get off, get off, get off, because of all the things that we are familiar with Hackensack and wall bombs and many others. So, but that's left for another series of stories and so forth. So some great lessons learned out of that particular incident. But materials, commodities, you're talking about fire in a mezzanine storage area that is up above. It's got a lot of storage, a lot of heat load. Guess what it's going to do? It's going to burn the wood. It's going to impact any type of steel or cast iron or metal components. So the metal's going to heat up and it's going to expand. The wood or any other products are going to be around are going to burn or paralyze. And it's just a whole sequence of events that requires us to stay on top of everything.
All right. So, well, we could talk all day about this. I just real quick note about the West Coast. I was doing my class in FDIC a few years ago, and I was talking about trusses and not cutting roofs, and I got a lot of blank stares from the West Coast, and we wound up doing a show at FDIC on roof ops in trusses. And that's just another one of those things that we do in New York where we don't operate on lightweight trusses, but they had their reasoning, and if it works for them, it's fine. So,
yeah.
You know, we're going to wrap it up a little bit because, you know, like I said, we could talk all day. What I'd like to do is, again, just guys, we're coming into like a new times now. This is I heard them talking about the new normal the other day on the TV, and things have changed in the last 6 weeks, like very, very rapidly. And this is very reminiscent of what I saw when I first came on the job. It was the very, very tail end of that era. And it seems like it might be showing itself again for forever. How long? I don't know if this is going to last, but and the economy, I don't know how long this is going to last either. And to some people, this may look like a viable option, you know, to get out of whatever hole they're in. So the firefighters are the ones that usually wind up bearing the brunt of it. If you're interested, there's a few things that you should look at. If you want, you could contact me. My email is very easy. It's just my name, Daniel P. Sheridan, at Gmail. You could contact me through Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I think easy enough to find. If you want what's written, FDNY taxpayers, I'd be happy to share it with you. I also have the chapters from Chief Dunn's Collapse of Burning Buildings on Trusses. I don't think he would mind if I shared that with you. I think this should be the topic of drill for the next however foreseeable future. I think we got to get our heads in the game and don't assume. People are out there to hurt us. It's just obvious now. I see on the news what's going on with the police, and sometimes we all get lumped into one big, one big group. And they're throwing bricks at fire trucks. That's very reminiscent of what happened 40 years ago, 35 years ago, when I was first coming into the fire department. I know fire companies are being attacked with bricks and airmail and all this other stuff. So these are new times we're in. So please drill on this stuff. Be very careful operating. There could be booby traps. There could be holes in floors. There could be – this was a trick that I haven't seen in a long, long time, where arsonists would start a fire with gasoline and then use some diesel in a different location, and then, you go past the fire, and next thing you know, there's fire lighting up behind you. You got to be careful. 2.5-inch hose for commercial buildings. Roof ops, identify the roof. Let the incident commander know what you got. Chris is an expert on roofs. He just spoke about it. And when in doubt, to all the battalion chiefs, deputy chiefs, incident commanders, if your gut's telling you that's not looking good, just pull them out. And that's why we got the big hose and the towel ladders and the deck pipes, So, Chris, any closing remarks before we wrap this up?
No, again, I think we've covered some good things on some insights. Danny, I'll offer this. So, I've got my podcast coming up on July 9th, and I think, you talked about doing a live program. I think we'll carry on the conversation next month if you'd like, and we'll do it live on the air at 7:30 on July 9th, and we'll talk a little bit more about some commercials and some tactics and operations. I think there's a wealth of information that we can expand upon. So, again, conservative in terms of your bias. Understand the rooftop conditions, both in terms of construction, the decking. Understand the era and vintage, the risk associated with the construction, and its building usage. Again, there's a lot of weight on those roofs in terms of what you're doing, especially with large open spanned areas. And that just gives us a building that's more highly susceptible to some bad things. And I just say, both from isolated or catastrophic failures to rapid fire extension. And it goes back to, Danny, what you talked about, just in terms of having adequacy of gallon per minute flow rates. And just know where you're at, what you're doing, understand the risks, understand building performance. So thanks for the opportunity to chat a little bit about this important topic today.
Thanks, Chris. Normally I would just say, if any guests want to call in, just call in. But this is pre-recorded, so we don't have that luxury. But anyway, Chris, thank you for being here. We'll be in touch. Everyone, please. Godspeed. Be safe out there. All right. This too will pass, as they say. This is not going to be, hopefully, God willing, long term. So until then, see you on the radio. Good night.